Okay. I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me an opportunity to tell you about some of our recent work, and I'd like to thank a lot of people for remaining for the 10th talk of today. So I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. So I'll try to sketch for you two results today, and I'll try to go through very intuitively the pictures for these two results. And the first part is work that I've done with Chris Laumann and Ashvin Vishwanath, and the second part is also with Dragos Potenirce and Monica Schleiersmith. So we've heard about a lot of different ways to think about many-body localization today, and I'd sort of like to take a little bit more of an information-esque way of thinking about localization. And for the purposes of this talk, we can kind of think about localization as the ability to remain quantum coherent locally. And maybe this is most easily explained using the opposite sort of idea, which is thermalization. So if we consider, for example, storing a simple quantum degree of freedom in a generic interacting system, for example, in the red spin located here, and if we just imagine doing time evolution of a generic high energy state, then what happens is that thermalization, or the entanglement of this particular degree of freedom with the many other degrees of freedom in the system, is basically what causes the loss of coherence. If we're in a generic many-body system, without the ability to look at sort of, you know, very non-local observables, it'll be very hard to reconstruct the information that was stored here. And with that in mind, sort of there are two sort of, you know, main conclusions, and the main sort of results from these two sections are: in the first part, I'd like to convince you that localization in combination with topology can actually lead to quantum coherence and quantum coherent dynamics at a finite energy density. And more importantly, it can lead to some local degrees of freedom that are coherent without the need for generic things when we think about qubits, without the need, for example, for cooling, for isolation, for decoupling pulses that are typical in experiments. And in the second, I'd like to consider a particular ultra-cold atomic system, that of Rydberg atoms. And I'd like to hopefully tell you that in this system, instead of maybe thinking about these ultra-cold atomic systems, they're extremely interesting for engineering and observing many-body localization. But the perspective I hope to give here is, instead of thinking about it as sort of engineering an additional ingredient in trying to observe MBL, that MBL, and in particular disorder, may be kind of a tool and actually may be some enabling physics to actually be able to observe some of the physics that we haven't been able to observe in these AMO-type systems. So I know there's lots and lots of experts in the audience. But just so that everyone's on the same page, I want to give just a very, very simple definition that will work for this talk in terms of symmetry-protected topological phases. These are phases of matter which are now kind of, we're thinking in contrast to sort of the theme of this particular conference. These are usually thought about at t equals zero. They're typically gapped phases without any sort of thing special in the bulk, so there's no particular bulk anionic degrees of freedom. They're connected to trivial insulators only if you break the symmetry that's protecting the topological order, or if you close the gap of the gapped phase. And three, maybe the most interesting thing, and the one that will be important for the purposes of this talk, are the fact that, you know, the interesting physics about this SPT order comes in the edge. So there's protected edge modes that exist here. And what I hope to do in the next few slides is to slowly lift this idea of SPT order from t equals zero, first to finite energy density, and then to construct some sort of a dictionary between this finite energy density SPT order and our phenomenological understanding of MBL. Hopefully I'll give an intuition for sort of how to do that. And the way I'm going to do that is actually very simple. I'm going to start with a very, very simple example, which is actually an all-commuting Hamiltonian example. So what I'm imagining here is a one-dimensional system of interacting spins, where the spins are interacting via three-body interactions that include three nearest neighbor, or not nearest neighbor, three adjacent spins of the form z, sigma z, sigma x, sigma z. This actually ends up being basically the spin one-half analog of the Haldane phase, for those who are experts. And so in this particular case, it's very easy to write down the symmetry that the Hamiltonian obeys, and the symmetry is actually the product of sigma x operators on both the even and odd sublattice. So now one can ask the question, okay, so now there's symmetry. We have some sort of a Hamiltonian for this one-dimensional object. Where are the edge modes that I was talking about? Where is the symmetry protecting these edge modes? And this concept is important. So here, we look at these ZXZ operators, and we know that they're all commuting with each other. We can easily see that. And what you also realize is actually that if there are initially n spin 1/2 degrees of freedom with a Hilbert space of size 2 to the n, there are actually n minus 2 ZXZ operators, which you can then sort of, you know, kind of specify a big portion of the Hilbert space via plus or minus 1 of these ZXZ operators. And this now indexes 2 to the n minus 2 pieces of the Hilbert space. So you're kind of missing 2 spin degrees of freedom, 2 spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. So kind of there's already an intuition that maybe there's some degrees of freedom that are missing. That these are edge modes, you can explicitly construct by writing down a set of Pauli operators, which are consistent with the Pauli algebra, which actually include only local terms, local microscopic spin degrees of freedom on the zero and the first site. So these are the left two most sites. And the important thing about this particular construction and where we can really intuitively understand how symmetry and these edge modes are related is that this particular construction satisfies the Pauli algebra, it is local, it lives on the edge, and most importantly, it is anomalous, or it is odd under the symmetry. All of the operators are odd under the Z2 cross Z2 symmetry. And this means that this particular edge modes can't appear in this Hamiltonian. And that's sort of the intuition for how to connect, you know, symmetry and topology and these particular protected edge modes. So we can now ask a very, very simple question. With this kind of a phenomenological understanding of this type of SPT order, you can ask, okay, how can I connect SPT order to many-body localization? Or more specifically, how do I connect to the Elbit Hamiltonian that we've already heard about from Antonello, David, all throughout the day? How can we sort of rectify these two? And what I'm going to try to do here is actually I'm going to try to go very, very slowly and construct what I'll call the SPT to MBL dictionary. So the phenomenological Elbit MBL Hamiltonian that we've seen is so-called the tau spin Hamiltonian, where each of the tau z's are sort of, you know, local integrals of motion that can in principle be constructed. And the example SPT Hamiltonian that I started out with was of course this ZXZ Hamiltonian. So you can ask, these two look actually very different from each other, so what's the dictionary that translates between them? Actually, in fact, it ends up being trivial, because this particular SPT Hamiltonian that I've written down is an Elbit Hamiltonian. I simply define tau zi as these sort of sigma zxz operators, which are integrals of motion, and immediately the Hamiltonian simplifies actually to a truncated version of this sort of very generic Elbit MBL Hamiltonian. And in this particular context, if I think about my edge modes that I was talking about in the previous slide, these are now correspond to edge Elbits, which you can imagine being sort of tau L's, and because they are symmetry odd, they cannot appear in this phenomenological Elbit Hamiltonian, at least in this commuting limit. But of course, this is kind of a bit of a trivial limit. I've started with an all-commuting Hamiltonian, and I've said, you know, I've ignored all notions of temperature. I don't need to worry about t equals 0 or non-t equals 0. And I have this coherent edge qubit, which is now an edge Elbit in the phenomenological Elbit Hamiltonian. But we can now make the system a little bit more generic. Let's add in generic local interactions of any sort that you want, and let's also add in strong disorder. If we believe that this, in the presence of strong enough disorder, this particular phase is localizable or can sit in a many-body localized phase, then we know that there's a new generic Elbit Hamiltonian with, I've now labeled these particular local integrals of motion as tau tilde. There's now a new generic Elbit Hamiltonian where actually the local integrals of motion, if we start thinking about this interactions actually perturbatively from this original Hamiltonian, are simply dressed versions, if we remember from Antonello's talk, are simply dressed versions of the original integrals of motion with extra two-body, three-body additional terms. So this kind of intuition is what I hope you'll think about when you think about relating this kind of sort of, you know, SPT physics to this sort of MBL Elbit type Hamiltonian. And the idea here is, and this idea sort of, you know, which was, you know, mentioned by a number of authors in the audience, is then that actually there can exist, as David said, a transition inside the sort of MBL phase where we consider this very generic disordered Hamiltonian. If the lambdas, the sort of, you know, ZXZ terms, are large and disordered, there can be a many-body localized SPT insulator. But if one has the H's being the largest parameters in the system, one can also have a many-body localized trivial insulator. And this idea is now that, you know, unlike at T equals zero, when it was really the gap that was protecting this particular edge degree of freedom and the coherence of this degree of freedom, now the point is, even at T greater than zero, the boundary in principle can host a single qubit degree of freedom. And this is now protected by the fact that the bulk is localized, so scattering events between the edge and the bulk are minimized. I want to emphasize that this is, you know, at present only a picture. This is a heuristic understanding. There's some nice analytic arguments. There's also some pretty nice numerical work. But this by no means is a fully complete story. But working with this particular definition of how to localize an SPT Hamiltonian, or this particular type of topological order, we can now ask a very simple question, which is, what exactly does it mean to have a qubit? You know, what would we want from this high energy density qubit? Is it just some sort of interesting idea? Well, maybe the two natural things that we might desire is, one, to be able to coherently store information in the qubit, and two, to be able to manipulate the qubit or perform dynamics with it in a coherent fashion. So in order to understand how this information is stored, we really need to understand how this L-bit enters the generic SPT L-bit Hamiltonian. So in the first limit, when it was all commuting, it didn't enter. But of course, now that we have, you know, a generic Hamiltonian with interactions and strong disorder, in the generic Hamiltonian, this Hamiltonian will consider all symmetry allowed terms, and there will be sort of you know, strings of operators where this Jij decreases exponentially with the separation of those operators. So the edge L-bits, much like the previous tau bits that we were talking about, the tau tildes, are also actually dressed by multi-body terms. And we also know that they're dressed in a way that have to be symmetry odd. So the only way that we can enter, we can have these two operators enter this symmetry even Hamiltonian, is by actually pairing them together. The simplest way to pair them together is simply to put them together and look at the exponential tails associated with their dressing. This will produce a generic term in the Hamiltonian, and the coefficient of that term will scale as e to the minus l. This, for all purposes, for all intensive purposes, this two tau spin interaction is a coherent interaction between the edge qubits. It, for example, can be leveraged to do useful information processing between them. But as we also know, there are many, many other terms that also exist and that enter into this Hamiltonian generically. In particular, we have both of our edge qubits, but we also have as many strings of tau as intermediate as we want, with the scaling e to the minus l and another prefactor. In this case, the sum of all of these terms basically becomes decoherence. This is where decoherence is in this model, because it basically means that there's dephasing, or the energy associated with this particular interaction depends on the intermediate state of the tau spins. And so this kind of is very, very different than the usual picture that we would think about in a non-sort of MBL system. In a non-MBL system, if you had a single qubit degree of freedom and you had an interacting generic system, as soon as it scatters with any of its neighbors, you lose information. But in this case, because of the symmetry protection coupled with the many-body localization, the symmetry protection tells you that in order to scatter, the only finite scattering matrix element requires having both of the operators in here. But then it tells you to have both of the operators in there, you actually need to go through this exponentially localized object, the bulk, and that's where you get this e to the l. So unlike sort of a very generic case where you don't have localization and you would just, you know, decay at the length scale of interaction, here we find that the coherence time associated with this localized topological edge qubit scales exponentially in the system size. And this, I want to emphasize, this sort of, you know, T2 star, as I've represented here, is in the absence of driving. There's no echoes being done, there's no driving, there's no perturbations that I'm applying. It's just long in the system size because of a combination of topology and localization. So one can also ask now, maybe the sort of a slightly broader question is whether or not one can also perform manipulations of this information, for example, by dragging it around dynamically. So at t equals zero, there's sort of a very simple lore, We know that basically both sides of the system, this trivial side and the topological side, and the boundary which binds this single qubit, are gapped. And now, if we basically shift the boundary, since the qubit is bound to it, the qubit will shift as well. And the qubit basically remains coherent so long as we go slower than the gap scale, which is basically protected by the adiabatic theorem. Now, you can ask the question, at t greater than 0, is this also true? And this is also true in the context of sort of MVL'd SPT phases. And so what we're sort of looking for here is a dynamic version of this static dictionary that we'd previously had. The question is whether, if I change some of the parameters of my microscopic Hamiltonian in time, is there a dynamic way to understand exactly what happens in sort of the localized basis or the local integrals of motion basis? That actually is a very, very hard question. And in general, is not known. But one can perform, one can do very, very simple numerics on the problem and show that in the presence of sufficiently large disorder, without getting into too many details, it's possible to coherently manipulate and move information around and return it to its original place and observe that the information has remained coherent despite these dynamics. And this adiabatic timescale is, in fact, set by the local spectral gap. Yes? Yeah, so actually, I think the two stories are consistent. So what Rahul is saying is basically, there's some nice work by Vedika, Rahul, and Shivaji, which look at what happens when you basically adiabatically, when you're truly adiabatic with respect to the many-body system, then you find that basically there can be, so you're adiabatic with respect to 1 over 2 to the n, there can be large-scale rearrangements. I agree that there are rearrangements on the scale of log tau, where tau is the rate, but since that's set by some local spectral scale, that's some order 1 scale for the size of that rearrangement. Yeah, no, but I'm saying it's a scale problem, right? I'm saying there are rearrangements. So if all we're arguing about is whether or not there exists rearrangements at a distance that scales with log of tau, then I think we agree. And I'm happy with that. But the statement is, so long as things are sort of far away relative to that scale, which is set by the local spectral gap, things are fine. But I think we can, why don't we discuss afterwards? Right. So with these two sort of statements present, one being that one can store information and one can also move this information around in some protected fashion, I'd like to sort of, maybe switch gears very quickly in the last few minutes and ask whether, is any of this observable? Where can one see this type of physics come out? There's maybe an interesting abstract story that I've told you already, which is that there could be a coherent SPT edge L bit at high temperature. But of course, we know that, basically getting interacting spin SPT phases are difficult. It's difficult to imagine having a material phase that has these particular properties. And when now sort of, there's been discussions where people ask, well, maybe ultra-cold atomic systems are the right venue to look for these phases of matter. I'd like to suggest that there are some interesting challenges. First is that, if you imagine trying to engineer such ZXZ or multi-spin type Hamiltonians for this spin 1/2 Haldane phase or Levin-Gu, you know that those are extremely challenging even in ultra-cold atoms. Actually looking at SPT order in the sort of SPT sense, the T equals 0 sense, is very challenging. Because even though we call them ultra-cold, they're actually extremely hot relative to the many-body gap. So it's very difficult to imagine how to cool these systems down. And we might say, in addition to all of these things that are difficult, you're now asking, or asking an experimentalist to now add in disorder and realize a many-body localized phase. That's even more challenging. But the perspective that I hope to get across here is actually that the fact that ultra-cold atoms are hot means that observing this SPT order or any type of sort of very non-trivial correlated physics at low energy density, at low temperature, is actually extremely difficult in these systems. And having localization, which allows for some remnants of these signatures of topological order to be present at high energy density, I think might actually be some sort of an enabling tool to help us observe this. In particular, We've recently been thinking about some work from Yaracola, Santos, and Shimon, where they've been thinking about a general strategy for engineering multi-spin interactions, for example, like ZXE, and the idea is to drive a simpler Hamiltonian. And this work, you know, follows in line with many questions that are coming out now about the phase structure of driven interacting disordered phases of matter. And so the basic statement is that in this system, if you imagine having a very simple transverse field Ising model and driving the Ising interaction between ferromagnetic and anti-ferromagnetic, what one finds is actually that at leading order in the frequency of the driving, one finds exactly the phase of matter corresponding to the spin 1/2 Haldane phase, the ZXZ Hamiltonian that we had written down earlier in the talk. And so the question here is now, well, is this a realistic system? Is there some realistic way to modify some Hamiltonian such that periodically the interactions switch between ferro and anti-ferro? That seems rather difficult. One might also complain that this is actually not generic. There's actually, you know, free fermions, which means that all orders, basically, in terms of the expansion, in terms of the Magnus expansion, this will also be free fermions. So what happens if one adds in some type of generic interaction? And what you see immediately is if you do add in a generic interaction, then what happens is that since you're driving, you might have the impression that periodically driving and adding energy into the system simply means that you're actually going to be very non-generic. You're never going to be able to get to the ground state. You can't actually observe this type of physics. And there's an interesting interplay between symmetry and decoherence in this case. So the particular system that I'd like to just, you know, give a little bit of a primer on as one way to, you know, leverage certain properties of an atomic system to get this type of interaction is Rydberg atoms. And Rydberg atoms, for the purposes of this talk, are very simple. They're simply atoms that are in electronic states with a principal quantum number which is much greater than one. So pictorially, what I mean is that you can imagine a ground state atom as having an electron which is extremely close to the core, but a Rydberg atom has an electron which is very, very far, very well delocalized. And this means that the effective dipole moment, or the polarizability of this Rydberg atom, is extremely high. And given that this polarizability is so high, it means that the interaction between two Rydberg atoms scales as n to the 11, scales as the principal quantum number to the 11th power, which is a very, very strong interaction. In the limit where this effective van der Waal interaction is actually repulsive, one can have experiments where the atoms want to crystallize with respect to each other. But the interesting thing about this particular system is that dependent on whether, you know, dependent on this particular Rydberg state that one looks at, there can be both attractive or repulsive interactions. So this actually gives a very, very simple picture for how one might be able to modulate between ferro and anti-ferro. You imagine coupling with a light field to a Rydberg state that's anti-ferromagnetic, and also with another light field to a state that's ferromagnetic. By modulating the intensity of this radiation field, you can modulate between ferro and anti-ferromagnetic couplings in a reasonably easy fashion. And with this picture in mind, you can actually, looking at a particular set of atomic states in cesium, for example, find out that it's reasonably possible to actually generate this type of a driven interaction and also be able to realize this kind of simple transverse field Ising Hamiltonian with an interaction. Of course, as I've already alluded to earlier on, what you find in this case is that the coherence, or the ability to even store a single edge degree of freedom in this L bit on the edge, it decays extremely fast. There's no quantum coherence. And this is exactly because what's happening is that, you know, you're scattering off local objects, and there's no localization that prevents you from actually killing the information. Once one actually adds in disorder simply on the on-site field, you find that, again, there's now an exponential enhancement of T2 star, much as in the MBL-SPT physics that I was mentioning earlier. And here, I think one of the nice things, you know, about this kind of perspective is really that observing this type of coherent edge degree of freedom previously in the SPT phase requires getting to low temperatures and low energy densities, which is extremely difficult. But in the presence of on-site disorder, actually, and many-body localization, if the topological order is consistent with localization, one can observe the signatures and at actually high energy density, which makes this sort of, you know, cooling requirement much easier to realize. Actually, I'd like to, with that, I think I'd actually like to stop and thank you for your attention and for, yeah. Perfect.
Thank you for stopping a little bit earlier. So, are there any questions here? Okay, I start here, then I go.
The Ritberg Adams had power law interactions, right? Is that a
That's a really good question, actually. So these van der Waals interactions have long-range tails, and so understanding how that exactly plays in is a good question. So Chris and I and company have thought about whether or not localization, at least, is consistent in the presence of power laws, and at certain limits it is, so long as the power law is short enough. But another statement is actually that given these power laws, even this sort of, you know, correlation length of this edge mode will also be a power law. And so you might imagine that then the signatures are harder to observe. But we don't think that having sort of a very weak next nearest neighbor term or next nearest neighbor term, so long as it's generic and in the MBL phase, will change the overall picture.
So getting back to Rahul's question, one of the things in their paper was this idea of a statistical orthogonality catastrophe, that sometimes it would work and sometimes it would not in terms of disorder configurations. Mm-hmm. So those results where you move the local qubit and then come back, is that robust? Do you see that in every disorder configuration or in some, or how robust is that?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So we see that in not every single disorder realization. So there are certainly cases where the localization length is very, very long and you see scattering, and so you don't actually have that. But I'd say in the majority of cases, actually, where you have strong enough disorder and you're pulling from that, then there's a very high likelihood that increases with that disorder strength asymptotically where that actually will work.
I just want to understand what was going on, because the Hamiltonian that you wrote is basically sum of two integrable Hamiltonians which are integrable separately but don't commute with each other. No, I mean previous with this nice integrals of motion sigma z.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah.
Here, this one.
Yes.
Okay.
So there are two terms which don't commute with each other, and you have localization either in this taus or in this sigma axis.
Yes. Sorry.
Let me just
Go ahead.
Finish.
Okay.
So for some reason, you assume that there is no chaotic region between them, and there is only a point in which one localized state transfers to another. Right. What are the reasons for that? Why usually when we consider Anderson model, it's exactly the same story.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So let me just start by saying two things. One thing that I didn't actually get to mention. One thing that is actually very nice that I'd like to mention here is that in the case where the lambdas are large, then the taus are the ZXZs. And what Boris was saying, which I didn't get a chance to say, is in the case where the Hs are large, the taus are simply the sigma Xs. But the sort of, you know, how sharp the boundary is, it depends on sort of, you know, how abruptly I change this particular parameter. So what I mean is, if in one regime of space I have lambda much larger, and immediately at lattice scale I change to another regime where lambda is much smaller than H, then things are pretty well localized to the edge. But then, if you actually have some gradient regime, then absolutely, there will be some edge mode which has large overlap with all of that particular gradient.
So you're saying lambdas and H's are anti-correlated somehow?
Well, yeah. You mean you want lambdas. If lambda's large, you're in the, you know, SPT insulator, and if H is large, you're in the trivial insulator.
So you never have situations where lambda and H commute.
You can. So, and in those limits, then things basically get, you know, exactly as Boris says, complicated. Exactly.
Okay, if there are no more questions, thank you.